Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through every Newbery Medal winning book, and then we talk about it. I'm Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
This time, we're talking about the 1961 Newbery Medal winning book, The Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell. But first, a couple of announcements. One, as always, you can email us if you have feedback for us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com. Newbery has one R. For those of you who might be confused, like I've been confused many times. But two, more importantly, tell your friends, tell your family, tell all of your social medias.
Run and tell that.
Media is already plural. Medium. If it's one social media, is it social medium?
Just go tell them what they're supposed to tell.
We're on Apple Podcasts. We're also on YouTube now. But we're not having video on YouTube. It just... Google Podcasts is going away, so they said you can upload your stuff to YouTube instead. So it's going to be just a static image with our audio, just like every other podcasting service. So if you had your friends who were holding out on this podcast because it was not on Apple Podcasts or not on YouTube, the wait is over. We're on there now.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Anyway, that's all we got before we jump into the regular episode. As always, we'll start with what we've been reading. So, Rebecca, what have you been reading?
Well, this first book we already talked about, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but Michael and I are reading with another friend of ours, The Waves by Virginia Woolf. And we're a pretty good way into it now.
I'm an even better way into it than you are.
Anyway, it's very good. I don't know too much to say about it, but... I won't give the plot synopsis because I feel like we did that last time. Although there's not really a plot synopsis.
It's also pointless. You don't read this book for the plot.
Basically, you're just following the story of this different group of friends and learning their characteristics through their own dialogue. Really, their internal dialogue. There's not any speaking back and forth.
There's zero. Like, it's all interior monologues.
Yeah, it's all their interior monologues, and it's very, very good. Love Virginia Woolf. I love her use of language. It just kind of is one of those things that if words could taste good, her words would taste good. If that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like when you read something and you're just like, that just sounds delightful and it feels good to say it and read it. This is sounding way more sexual than I intended it to be.
Sexual?
But the book is really good.
You're saying tasting good.
The book is really good.
Culinary.
Was heavy on Ann Patchett this month. I'll talk about the two I read for it. I read What Now, which is not really a book. It's more, she had given this, what's it called when you speak at a graduation? Commencement address? Is that what it's called?
Sure.
She gave one of those out of school. And I don't remember what school it was now.
Harvard.
But she expanded it into like a whole long essay about oh my gosh, guys. I'm just struggling. She expanded it into a whole piece of nonfiction. It's called What Now? So I listened to that. It was very good. And then I read her novel Run, which was about these two black brothers who are adopted by a white politician in Boston. And they end up reuniting with their biological mother and sister through a strange course of events and just really exploring their story. I thought that was really, really well done. And it offers a lot of commentary about race relations without being really heavy on that, which I appreciated because it is written by a white woman, so I appreciate that she doesn't try to, like, speak a lot of insight into something that she hasn't experienced directly, and I think she toes that line really well. So that was good. It was not her... it was definitely not her strongest... But let me tell you what has been her strongest. This is not as good as Bel Canto, but I finally got to read Tom Lake, which was her most recent novel that she came out with last year, and it was phenomenal. It was truly phenomenal. It did help that the audiobook version that I was reading was read by Meryl Streep, so it was incredible.
Wow.
this book is just so good. It's set in the pandemic, in the quarantine period of the pandemic, because, and it's about this family who has an apple orchard, and it's a mother and a father and their three daughters. And the whole framework of the novel is that the mom is telling the story of, like, her young adult life in the theater. And she had dated this famous actor for a while, so she's talking about how they met.
Is that Tom?
No, it's not. Tom Lake is the name of the area where all these things happened.
It's confusing. They shouldn't name an area a name.
But it transitions into how she met their father. It was kind of like How I Met Your Mother, but it was How I Met Your Father. And all these other people that she dated along the way. But it's not just about that. It also talks about the girls' like day-to-day life, and it also explores the struggle of if they're going to be able to keep this orchard, if they're going to be able to keep the farm going. And I was talking with one of my friends at church about this book who also read it, and we were just talking about how nothing super intense happens in this book. There's not, like, a major plot twist. There's not, like, this major climactic moment. But it is such a beautiful story. And the way that she's able to write a story that's set in the pandemic without making me feel anxious and nervous is truly incredible. I was very nervous to read this book for a while when I did find out that it was set in, like, 2020. I was like, I don't think I'm ready to go back there, but I just think it's very well done. It's definitely an example of when Aunt Patchett is at her best. So it was fantastic. Another, and the last book I'm going to talk about, but another fantastic book that I read was The House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende. And this book is just beautiful. This is another one where the words are just delicious. Like, it's so good. So this story is very expansive. I'm not going to try to summarize the plot for you because just a lot happens. But if you don't know, Isabel Allende's cousin was the leader of Chile, was the president of Chile.
Salvador.
And
Salvador Allende.
Yes, Salvador. And he, there was a coup d'etat, and he
sponsored by the CIA.
Yeah, he ended up in the midst of that taking his life when he was about to probably be assassinated. And so Isabel is writing about, it's not a nonfiction work, but she's writing about that whole experience. And what's crazy is she was writing this in real time. Like, I think she was in exile when she had fled
Chile because her family was being assassinated by, the ascendant right-wing party.
So to just weave a story like this where she is also very, I wouldn't say sympathetic, but she's also writing from the perspective of, like, right-wing leaders in the country who really set this coup up and then was really surprised by the results when the military took over and they weren't even in power anymore. I just think she does a fantastic job. This book switches perspectives a lot from different characters and telling their story. And it tells the story of, I think, at least three generations, maybe more than that, but it's at least three. But the book is phenomenal. I highly recommend it. And I get to go to Chile in December, so I'm excited to read this book before I get to go.
I'm very jealous that Rebecca will get to defile Pinochet's grave before I will.
I won't be doing that. But anyway, what have you been reading, Michael?
Well, I've read a few things, all of which are nonfiction, actually, except for the two books we're going to talk about today. I say two books because there's a sequel to Island of the Blue Dolphins that I read that I'm sure I'll talk about in the main discussion of the book. But I'll just go in chronological order with things that I've in the order I finished them. The first two are kind of a pair, because our church is this fall going to do a study of the Book of Judges in the Bible, and I'm on what's called the teaching team, which means that we have a meeting, like a retreat sort of thing, where we all kind of like weigh in on what could be taught, like, from this book. Rebecca will be part of that too, by the way.
Well, and I'm on staff, so that means I haven't read anything in preparation.
That's all right. You don't need to have read these things, but I did, because I'm boring. These books are pretty dry academic books, but I read two academic books on the Book of Judges. I usually just, when I'm on these things, the book studies, I will just go to our local library and see what they have, and these were the two books that they had, so I read them both. The first one is called Warrior, Dancer, Seductress, Queen, Women and Judges in Biblical Israel by Susan Ackerman, and the second one's called The Empty Men, because you can't have an academic text without a colon in the middle. The Heroic Tradition of Ancient Israel by Gregory Mobley, I'm not sure which. Anyway, they're both like academic studies of the Bible. Both of them are, in a lot of ways, literary analyses of the Book of Judges. Ackerman's book focuses on women in the Book of Judges, whereas Mobley's book focuses on like the kind of the ways that these heroes and judges are constructed. And both of them are kind of doing this in conjunction with like bringing in texts from outside the Bible to kind of look at like how does this compare and connect with other writings in like ancient Southwest Asia. So they're interesting. They are like very much like academic texts about the Bible, which means that there's a lot of like footnotes and like citations of like other authors that you probably haven't read, and I haven't read at least. You know, that sort of thing. There's a lot of really minute kind of parsing of language. And anyway, I kind of go in and out of these books. You know, some of it is really interesting to me, some of it isn't. Of the two that I read, I would say Ackerman's book is better. And I think, like, if you're studying the Bible and you're studying Judges, like, this is a fairly, like, major text in the study of the Bible. I think Susan Ackerman is, speaking as someone who doesn't really know this field very well, I think she's a pretty major figure in this. And anyway, they're worth reading if you're interested in that sort of thing. If you're not, they are definitely not building any bridges to people who are not interested. So take that as you will. The third book I read, which kind of is a little bit academic as well, but not nearly as much, is called After Black Lives Matter by Cedric G. Johnson. I picked this up kind of on a whim at a local bookstore, and basically it's analysis of like the class dynamics surrounding like the like police brutality, and then also the like anti-police brutality movement that kind of culminates in Black Lives Matter from like 2015 to 2020-ish. And the book came out like I think late last year or early this year, but it's mostly just going up through 2020 with the big, you know, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor adjacent protests. And like basically this author's big critique is basically critiquing Black Lives Matter from the left. And so, like, you know, as people are wont to do on the left, you know, he likes, you know, he's really big on analyzing the ways that like Black Lives Matter and the like anti-police brutality movement has and hasn't worked within like the class dynamics of like modern cities, because that's another really big concern of his, is like how are cities laid out? How has, in the kind of like post-industrial, like neoliberal age, how have cities kind of become class stratified in ways that they weren't before? And how does that map onto policing? He uses this term surplus population to describe the people that police interact with the most, which would be people who struggle to fit into like a kind of modern capitalist employment structure. So people who are homeless, or just simply people who are finding ways, means of employment that aren't stable, or people who are making money through ways that are illegal. So, you know, like sex workers, or like in the case of some people who have been killed by police, like selling things that are illegal, whether that's drugs or like unregulated, like loose cigarettes or whatever. And basically he's saying that like the anti-policing movement needs to switch to dealing with the causes of the way that police interact with society now, So basically trying to eliminate the presence of that surplus population. So he's really big into these kind of like New Deal era, like jobs programs and like, so like WCA and, or WPA, sorry. Right? Is that what it's called? The, anyway, like the big social projects that like the New Deal did.
Yeah, I think WPA is right.
It's WPA and CCC, right? Civilian Conservation Corps. He thinks that we should reinstate that in order to gainfully employ people who otherwise are resulting in like kind of violent confrontations with the police, and also doing that in order to, you know, obviously just like make people suffering within a modern city mitigated, because. You know, within cities, especially, you know, post, like, 80s, you have, like, cities that basically are driving income based on, like, real estate and tourism. Like, that's kind of, like, the two big, like, financial drivers of a lot of cities. And that obviously leaves a lot of people out, especially in cities that have been kind of structured around what would have been once, like, industrial work. So he thinks that the federal government and local city, like local jurisdictions, should create jobs programs, and that would be a more effective way of dealing with police brutality than simply the ways that like Black Lives Matter has like kind of confronted police exclusively around like kind of racial dynamics. So he's not denying the racial dynamics, but he's saying that like if you only focus on race, you're not dealing with one of the root causes of the problem, which is the fact that most of these people who have violent encounters with the police are also in the surplus population of people who don't really fit into the employment structure of cities as they're laid out right now. Anyway, that book was good, really interesting, kind of a little bit on the academic side of things, but a lot more readable than I would say the other two, like biblical books. Like not as much for the academy as those two. So
yeah.
Anyway, I've also been reading The Waves, but Rebecca already talked about that. Anyway, that's what I've been reading.
Yep.
Well, we're now onto the Island of the Blue Dolphins.
Yeah, and you get to talk about the author.
Correct. Scott Odell, which, in a plot twist, a very, very big plot twist, his name is not actually Scott Odell, but it is not a pen name. So he was born Odell Gabriel Scott in 1898 in Los Angeles. And apparently, like, I can't find what the exact piece of writing this was. But as like an early part of his writing career, a piece of his was published where there was like a typographical error that switched his first and last name. So he became Scott Odell instead of Odell Scott. And he apparently liked that so much that he has his name legally changed to Scott Odell. So he is actually Scott Odell, but that's not how his story begins. Most of this comes from his website, which he died in 1989, so this was not a website that he curated personally, unless he was really on the vanguard of the internet. So I don't know who's keeping this up, but they have a really great bio section for him, and most of this I got from that. He was a track star at Long Beach Polytechnic High School, and then he went to four different colleges, so Occidental College in California. He went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, he went to Stanford University, and he went to the University of Rome. Somewhere in that, I'm not sure exactly when he went to all those different colleges, but he also enlisted in the Army in World War II in 1918, but the war ended before he could actually be commissioned, and so he was discharged. But he apparently was a big military guy, because in World War II, he also enlisted in the Air Force, and also the Coast Guard. I don't know why they switched him around, but he never saw combat then either. He was almost 40 by that time anyway, so well beyond like kind of like prime soldier age. But regardless, he has an Air Force background, or military background, I should say. But also, he's got a lot of other backgrounds too. This dude is one of the most interesting people that we've looked at. He after World War II, started working in Hollywood, which, you know, at the time was silent film. He worked for Paramount Pictures for a while and started as a set dresser, but eventually had some, like, I guess, like, occasions to be in front of the camera. He made the cut in one movie. You can see his hand in a movie called The Son of the Sheik. And apparently, Rudolph Valentino's hands were too, like, short and stubby to look good in this one shot where it's just a hand. So his hand is kind of like the body double for Rudolph Valentino, which whoever's writing this biography is on his website calls it his slender, tapered fingers, as opposed to Rudolph Valentino's stubby, short-fingered hands. Because
sure.
I love that they thought his fingers were sexy. Anyway, he also went to work for MGM and was a cameraman on the silent film version of Ben-Hur. So this isn't like the 1950s, like Charlton Heston Ben-Hur, the silent version, also directed by Cecil B. DeMille. That was filmed in Italy, at least in part, and he liked Italy so much that he just stayed after the production was done. And in Florence is where he wrote his first novel, but he apparently did not like that novel. He burned the manuscript, and so no one's ever read it. But in 1934, he did publish a novel called A Woman of Spain, and his early career, he's mostly writing for adults. The Island of the Blue Dolphins is actually his first novel for children. So he had been writing for several decades by that point. Apparently, and this is a direct quote from him, when he was interviewed about Island of the Blue Dolphins, he said this: "Island of the Blue Dolphins began in anger at the hunters who invaded the mountains where I live and who slaughter everything that creeps or walks or flies." So we'll talk about this, but there is a strain in Island of the Blue Dolphins that's kind of ecological where she befriends animals and eventually becomes kind of opposed to killing some of these animals. And that was apparently reflecting like his own personal beliefs as well. So he kind of worked with like animal activism a little bit, or maybe not activism, but he kind of lived out this. Like, he became a director of an animal shelter in another town in California that he lived. And he lived, that town is called Rancho Santa Fe. And he moved there in 1970, I think, from some other place in Southern California. And he lived there until 1975, and when he moved to Mount Kisco, New York, which is somewhere upstate. And he lived there till his death in 1989, where he died of prostate cancer. I'll just end. He wrote lots of books. There's a whole literary award named after him. Mm-hmm. He became a very significant figure in children's literature.
He had two other Newbery honors. Right? The Black Pearl and then another one, too.
Definitely the Black Pearl, because his website mentioned that. I don't know about another one, but
yeah.
I think
he had two, and then one with Island of Blue Dolphins.
So I'm kind of skipping over, like, the thing he's most famous for, which is writing all these children's books.
Mm-hmm.
This comes
into play with this book.
Yeah, and I don't know. Like, his children's books are his children's books, and that's, like, interesting in and of itself, but he has so much other interesting stuff about his life before he was writing children's books that I thought I'd kind of focus on that. And I'll just end with this, and this is also directly from his website, which I thought was kind of like a poetic and kind of sweet way that it talks about his life having ended. So after he died, he was cremated, and his ashes were scattered over the Pacific Ocean off of La Jolla, California. I don't know how to pronounce it, but in the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, when the ceremony was completed and the boat was turning back to the shore, a pod of dolphins, like, basically accompanied the boat back to shore.
Wow.
And his website calls it that they said that they formed an honor guard and leapt and played and escorting a boat of mourners, and didn't leave until the boat entered San Diego Bay.
That's beautiful.
I know. It sounds fake, but I hope it's not, because it's really lovely.
well, we're going to choose to believe that it's real.
We're going to print the legend here. Anyway, super interesting guy. What a life that he led. Now we're going to talk about Island of the Blue Dolphins, his first children's book. Rebecca.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So this book is based off the real-life story of a woman named, this was not her, this was a name given to her, Juana Maria. She was a Nicoleña Native American woman who was the sole resident of San Nicolas Island off the coast of California for around 18 years in the 19th century. She lived there for longer than 18 years, but she was there alone for about 18 years. I mean, we don't have many details of her life because many people have reported that no one could understand her language when she was rescued from the island, though there have been some later reports that have said that some indigenous folks were able to understand her and converse with her. But there were only, from what I read, there were only four words that people largely were able to translate from what she, from her language. So Odell had to fill in a lot of these blanks for us. So this is an historical fiction novel. This is not like a work of nonfiction. The protagonist's name that she shares with people outside her community is Karana, though her secret real name is Wanapale, I guess is how you'd say it. She lives with her brother, her sister, and her father, who is the chief of the island. Galasat, I think is the name of it. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway.
I don't know. The Island of the Blue Dolphins is how it's supposed to translate, though.
Yes.
Because it looks like an a dolphin from the ocean, right?
Right. So, there is this group of Alouette, I think is how you say it, Alouette hunters.
Which is another, that's another Native American tribe, right?
Well, I was reading about them. They're indigenous Alaskan people, and a lot of Russia and Alaska has, like, fought over their dominance.
Wow.
So if that tells you where they are geographically. Anyway, so they come to the island with a Russian captain. So it's a Russian mission, you know, that is not like mission-like missionaries, but a Russian group.
It's like a fur trapping group. Right?
Basically, these people are in slavery, but the book doesn't say that. So the Alouette hunters come to the island with a Russian captain in order to hunt otter. There's a disagreement about payment toward the end of their stay, which results in a massacre. Karana's father dies, and many of the other members of her community. So the newly elected chief travels off the island to get help, and a lot of time passes until a group of people that he basically sends from a mission, where it doesn't specify in the book where they're from, but from the real life story, we think they're from Santa Barbara, they come to save them. So Karana gets on the ship with everybody, but she can't find her little brother. So when she realizes he's still on the island, she jumps off the ship and swims back to shore, and they both hope that, well, more help will come to get us. You know, they know we're here. They're going to come back and get us. Very soon after that, I'm pretty sure the same day.
It's very quick in the book. I'm not sure.
It still grieves me. I'm still mourning. But very soon after this, her brother is killed by a pack of wild dogs, and then she's left all alone on the island to fend for herself. So the book really largely focuses on her, lone attempts to survive. She domesticates this dog, who was the leader of the pack that actually killed her brother. And then she learns to love and care for all these other animals on the island, while also considering, if these people come back, if these hunters come back, how will I protect myself? So she, makes these places in caves where she hides her things if she needs to escape or if she needs to survive in there for a little while. So many years, it's unspecified how many, pass. And then another group of Alouette, I really hope I'm saying that right, hunters come. And they come with a woman who befriends Karana. Karana hides from the men, but after this interaction with the woman, they end up leaving the island. But after this interaction with the woman, that's when she starts to realize how much she really longs for this, for human connection. Like, she misses her sister, she misses her people. And when more help finally does come, well, I don't know if they're coming to help her because they don't know she's there, but when more people finally come to the island, Karana does go with them. And they then tell her when she gets back to the mission that the reason help did not come for her sooner is because the original ship from the mission sank soon after making it to harbor. So that's really the synopsis. of the book. We'll talk a little bit more about the historical context when we get to the what we liked and what we didn't like, but is there anything you would add to that synopsis?
No, I think that's good. I mean, the large majority of the book is her just surviving. It kind of fits into, like, I read this as a kid, and I remember in my mind this kind of fit into, like, that kind of subgenre of children's book, like Hatchet or My Side of the Mountain or those sorts of things where, like, this isolated child has to figure out how to survive. Although she's not really a child in this book. She's, like, older. In fact, one of the things that I didn't mention about Scott O'Dell when he wrote Island of the Blue Dolphins is he initially didn't write it as a children's book. He just wrote it.
It was intended as a book for adults.
Right. And then another literary person he knew told him, like, this actually sounds like it could be a book for children. And so it became that. But she's not young. Like, she's, I'd say at the youngest, like, late teens, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's what she's meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that squares with, like, history. And by the end of the book, she's
a woman.
You know.
She's grown.
She's, like, middle-aged by the end of the book, it sounds like.
Well, she was in real life. She was, like, in her 40s or 50s, they think, in real life. But the book, I feel like she could still, I don't know. I feel like she would be more of our
age. She lives long enough that, like, the dog that she domesticates dies of old age.
Yeah, that's true.
And she domesticates a new dog.
That's right.
So yeah. It's, like, decades, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
What did you like about this book?
I liked a lot about it. I think that I didn't know it was written for adults originally, and it makes sense that it's written for adults in a way that it's not like it's, like, super, like, edgy or talking about really adult things, although it does kind of brush up against a lot of that. But I think that, like, one of the things that I really like about the book is that unlike a lot of children's literature with, like, a central protagonist, this is a kind of a double-edged sword, but, like, it simply presents things as they are, and there's not a lot of, like, apology or justification for them happening within the story. And so, like, she is narrating in the first person, but it is a very unobtrusive narrator, you know, and it's very pragmatic, which I think sometimes makes it, like, really striking in ways that probably people wouldn't think to write it had it been a more, like, active traditional children's narrator. So, like, the kind of, like, really horrific things that, like, happened to her and her, like, people, like, early on in the book are really matter of fact in a way that almost, like, makes them very stark and, like, surprising rather than, like, they're not for, like, you know, and sometimes I wonder, like, why it's so, like, the voice is so distanced, and we can talk about that later on, but I think sometimes that works really well, just stylistically, that, like, we don't really get that much, like, interiority from this character. Is simply, like, her observing what's around her and her surviving, like, purely on, like, pragmatism. Although we also kind of see, like, this growing, like, ideology from her where she starts, as she becomes more dependent on the animals around her and more entwined in, like, the ecosystem rather than entwined in, like, a society, she becomes a lot more sympathetic to the animals. And I think that's kind of an interesting development as well. So I really like that. Some of the writing is really, it's very spare, like almost like Hemingway-esque, but I think the writing is really, like, evocative too, in ways that a lot of children's books simply aren't. I don't know, I mean, a lot of this book is very, like, incident-driven, you know, there's not, like, a overarching, like, dramatic engine, like, driving the plot, like, in a page-turning way, but, like, as a survival story, like, it's almost, like, journal-esque and, like, very, mm-hmm. very, like, sober-minded in terms of, like, the sorts of things that have to happen, but also, like, open to, like, actually, like, kind of exploring, like, little philosophies, like, Scott O'Dell's, like, interest in animal rights and things mm-hmm. like that that come up. So, I don't know. I read this, and I'll kind of talk about this book in two phases, because there's the version of me that read this book as a child and then also reread it as an adult, and there's the version of me that looked at the historical context and then kind of had a new feelings about the book. But all that I said was kind of like on first reading as an adult after having read it as a child. Like, those were all the things I liked.
Mm-hmm. I liked a lot of those same things. This is a very beautiful book. The prose, I think, is strong. The descriptions of nature are really beautiful. The relationship she builds with animals is really admirable. And like Michael said, this was Odell's aim, to write, specifically to quote Wikipedia, his aim was to write a book to promote a respect for all forms of life after witnessing animal cruelty near his home. Some of this you already said. So for its time, I do wonder if this book was more progressive in terms of how Indigenous folks were portrayed, although it was problematic, which we'll get into.
Sorry. I read an interesting thing about that, which maybe you'll talk about later on, but like, some people have talked about, and I might have just read this on Wikipedia, so I'm sorry if you're about to say this, but some people have talked about how the narrator being so distant and we're not really in her head a whole bunch has allowed the book to be kind of like a blank slate in terms of like what you want to project. Because it's like, in some ways you can interpret this as like a feminist book because she's like this like woman who like ends up questioning some of the gender roles in her society because of the pragmatism. In some ways you can view this as a kind of more generous portrayal of Native Americans than was common at the time. Again, because we just don't have that much in her head, it doesn't indulge in some of the stereotypes that people might have otherwise. But some people think that's like accidental. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna say that, but I think that's a really good point. But what I was gonna, I do think it shows her intelligence. It shows her ability to adapt. It shows her resiliency, and that's where a lot of this book is focused on, is her resiliency. And then just, like Michael was saying, like just changing her mind in order to find new ways to survive in pretty beautiful ways. Those are the things that I liked. What'd you dislike?
Well, so I'm going to start this by, maybe, and you can jump in too. After I finished the book, at the end of my edition, there's an author's note by Scott Odell, which reading this, I didn't realize it was based on a true story until I got to this author's note, and I was like, okay, now that I know that this is based on a true story, there's some weird stuff in here that I'm, like, curious about. One of them was, like, throughout the book, and I just assumed this was a product of the time, but if he's reflecting the historical narrative, I was curious, like, all of the white people who come are benevolent. Like, they are all here to rescue these poor people who have been massacred by this other Indigenous tribe. And I'm like, that can't be the whole story, which it wasn't. The other thing I was curious about is like, okay, so if this is a real person, like what happens to her? Because the book ends with her leaving the island, and I'm like, did she ever reconnect with like her family? Like what happens? Like the book kind of does not explain that. Like, and so I went and redid this too, Rebecca, kind of looked at the research and like, to be honest, like, it really shifted how I felt about the book. So, I will say, all the stuff I just said about the book stands. Like, that's legitimate. However, my view of it has been forever tinted by reading the real history, because the true story of this is so horrific. Like, it's awful. Like, what basically happens, like, is this is the story of the extermination of a people group. Like, that's, like, what the history of this is. And that's kind of sort of vaguely implied in the book because she's the only one left on the island. But, like, what happens is that, so the Russians bring in this, these other Indigenous folks who are basically enslaved, right? Like Rebecca said. And because the Russians bring them in on a, like, a fur trading, like, a fur trapping mission, which results in the scuffle and the conflict that happens in the book. But in real history, it's kind of disputed like what remained of like the people on the island after the massacre happens. But the tribe was decimated and women were raped, and like some people think there are only a handful of people remaining on the island. The book doesn't really portray it like that. But basically, the natives decide it's an unsustainable, we can't live on the island with the number of people who remain. So
some records say there were just like seven. Just like seven people and hardly any men.
Right, which is, they talk about in the book.
Right.
And so they decide to leave the island with the missionaries who come. Mm-hmm. There's differing accounts, although the one with her jumping back and swimming back to shore to save her brother is in the historical record for some accounts, but it's not in all the accounts. There's right. differing reasons.
Some people think it was, some records have that it was her child that died and not her brother when she was on the island. Yeah, anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's okay. You did actually more research than I did, so you should jump in.
Okay.
Anyway, it turns out that like, basically saves her life, because when the remnants of these island people land in the mission, they, like, survive only a matter of weeks. They all die of, like, dysentery or cholera or, like, you know, the kinds of things that, like, people often died of at the time, but I guess in the isolated, like, ecosystem of the island, like, they were even more vulnerable to it than a lot of other people. And so, like,
they'd never been exposed to it.
Right. They did not survive at the mission whatsoever. Like, so, like, between the massacre that I think we can reasonably blame the Russian colonialism mm-hmm. of, like, bringing this other enslaved, mm-hmm. you know, people group. Like, between the Russians and then the missions who, I think there's a lot of problems with how, like, the, like, Spanish missions enacted, like, you know, their relations to the indigenous people in the American Southwest. But it seems well-intentioned, but they also brought them to a place where they just died. Between those two things, like, she was literally the only person left of her tribe. And when they picked her up on the island later on, like, years later, decades later, they couldn't understand her, mm-hmm. like Rebecca said. But they decided to baptize her and give her this name regardless.
Because she was dying.
She was dying, yeah. Mm-hmm. In the mission, she also died of dysentery at the mission after just a matter of weeks, just like everybody else did. And they couldn't understand her. She did not understand them. Like, it just seems like this horrible situation where this woman is completely isolated. And once she finds, like, contact with human society again, she is still isolated and then just dies. They christen her as, like, a, you know, and give her a name and that, you know, makes
Maria.
That makes sense to them. Mm-hmm. And that in itself seems problematic to me, because it's like this woman didn't even know what was happening to her, and they were kind of like pretending she was converted. I don't know. And she just dies, and that's the end of the story. And to me, that really makes this book, like, I just have to question. I understand wanting to tell, it's really interesting, this woman mm-hmm. lived on this island by herself for decades. Like, that is really interesting, and I can imagine wanting to tell that, but wanting to tell that story completely divorced from any of the context of, like, this is this woman's last decades alive, mm-hmm. isolated from the people that she loved, who also had just died. Like, it feels tasteless. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much research Scott O'Dell actually did. And it sounds like he did a little bit more research. So there's a kind of pseudo sequel to this that takes place at the mission, called Zia, which I read, which was published in, like, the 1970s. And that is a lot more focused on, like, the relationship of, like, Europeans and European descendants and the mission to the indigenous people. So it does seem like Scott O'Dell had some, like, understanding of, like, that sort of dynamic. But I don't know. Like, initially I thought, like, well, this is simply not a story for children, so why did he write a children's book about a story that he could not tell in whole? But then he didn't write it for children initially, so I don't know what... I don't know. I just really question, like... I don't question why this book was written in general, because it's an interesting story. Mm-hmm. But I have to wonder, like, why did he leave out all this other stuff? Because that's the main thing of the story, is that this is the last surviving person of this, mm-hmm. this society who did not survive after she left the island. Like, that, mm-hmm. that whole thing like now hangs heavily over my understanding of the book. What did you think, Rebecca?
Well, I do think, though, I agree with those things, and I also think it is a beautiful portrayal of the life she forged for herself. For that many years to survive on your own and to form this relationship with the island and with the other living creatures who were there, I think is really a beautiful story of survival. Although her survival ended when she made it to where she should have found safety. So I think that there are a lot of problematic elements of this story, but I am glad that the majority of the book really focuses on her means of survival on the island and just Odell dreaming about like what that might have looked like. So what I did find some articles and some posts written by Debbie Reese, who is an Indigenous American woman who founded an organization called the American Indians and Children's Literature. And this is an organization and a website that offers critical analysis of Native and Indigenous peoples in children's literature. And so a lot of her work highlights how children's literature that's written about Native Americans implies that they're no longer present, while that is not true. And so I really enjoyed hearing from an Indigenous person about like their perception of this novel. I am going to try to figure out if we can give you some links in the blurbs of this podcast to take you directly to her works, because I do want to highlight what she has to say more than what we have to say about this book. But some of the things that I read, I just wanted to share with you guys because it really highlights some of the problematic elements of this book, and just books in general that tell Indigenous people's stories, but from the perspective of a person who's not Indigenous. And I think, you know, this really highlights some of the things that biases that can come up, or just a lack of understanding that you will just never have. So let me get myself back on track. So some of the things that she highlights is there are a lot of harmful stereotypes that Odell uses in this book. She does offer a good explanation of what he had to go on at the time and what other cultural moments were happening that influenced that. And, like, this is a stark difference between, like, she mentioned specifically the John Wayne movie, The Searchers, which came out around the same time that Odell was writing this, which has a very different portrayal of Indigenous people. They also say
it's also about a maniac like genociding them,
right?
Too.
Exactly. But what one of the I'll probably get to it a little bit, but some of the scholars talk about how Odell gives like two stereotypes of Indigenous people: the savages, who are the Aleuts, and like the more stoic, kind, like, connected with nature, Indigenous people, who is Karana. We'll get into that in a little bit. But anyway, there's another scholar that wrote that the stoic characterization of Karana and her manner of speaking without contradictions are stereotypical Hollywood Indian depictions rather than ones that might be called authentic. So that's one of my biggest complaints about the book, is that when her brother dies, it is so anticlimactic. Like, we don't get to see her really grieve.
Yeah.
We don't get to see her, like she jumped off the ship to save him. And it seems like almost immediately in the book, he is gone. And so that in itself, like, she grieves more over her dog that dies than she does her brother. And I don't know why Odell does that. Like, doesn't seem natural for anybody, and I don't know if this was, like, that just seemed very weird to me.
I meant about how it's, like, a double-edged sword. Like, there's some ways that, like, her is this kind of stoic protagonist who we really don't really get very much emotional, you know, nakedness from. Like, sometimes that works really well, but other times, like, I agree, her brother's death is almost, like, it's almost, like, brushed over. She's, like, looking for him, and she's, like, oh, there he is. He's killed by dogs at the end.
Like, and it was one of those things, like, as soon as her brother wanders, it starts to allude to the fact that she's worried about him wandering. And I just remember thinking, they better not kill this boy. They better not do it. And then it happens.
Had you read this before?
I have, but I don't remember it. I didn't remember hardly anything about it. So anyway, then there's this other scene where it's a beautiful scene about how she is trying to get, is it a devil fish?
Yeah, it sounds like basically like an octopus.
She's trying to get it because it would give her a lot of food and all these things, and it's really hard for her to capture. It's really hard for her to kill. She finally catches it and kills it, and it's this harrowing journey. And then she's too tired to pull it out of the water, and we move on. And I was just like, why did you do that? Why did you do that to me? And I'm sure that there's, like, a point to that, and that's probably, like, real life. You know, like, when your biggest battles, once they're won, you don't know what to do with them. You know, like, I don't know. I'm sure there's something to be said for that, but I just felt very, like, what in the world's happening? But some other things that they say is that Island of the Blue Dolphins is a lot like most books and media about American Indians that give the audience the kind of Indians that America loves to love. And this is part of talking about. Odell gave us both the savage ones and the gentle ones. And Reese says, in a spirit of generosity, it is possible to justify why his story met with such success, but how do we justify an embrace of it in the present time when we know so much more about accuracy and authenticity of representation? There is a fascination, a nostalgia, and a yearning for the romantic Indian and all that Indian means to people who think the best life anyone could have is one of the Indian of yesteryear, living in the pristine wilderness where the weight of the world is not on your shoulders, where you can breathe clean air and drink clear water. The nostalgia also captures the imaginings of the perfect childhood, but neither one is or was real. As such, Island of the Blue Dolphins is a perfect example of a book at the center of the canon of sentiment.
Well, I think that
I just want to finish this quote, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Indeed, the canon of sentiment exists to preserve the childhood of those adults who create that canon, and to preserve the affection those adults feel for the books within it. A good many adults imagine the childhood Odell described and the survival that Karana experienced. We like to think we could survive too, and a story like this one lets us see how that could happen. Nonetheless, the story is lacking in its accuracy and suitability for informing children about American Indians. Will there come a time when there's a critical mass of gatekeepers rejecting works like this? She says, I hope so. Sentiment is no excuse for ignorance. And I do want to say, we are not pro-censorship or removing books from libraries or anything like this. I think Reese's point is more about, like, what books about Indigenous people do we include in the canon of children's literature? And why is a book written by a white man that doesn't accurately describe what happened and actually villainizes an entire other group of Indigenous people? Like, that shouldn't be the center of our canon. So I just wanted to specify that. Another article that I found highlighted other fictional books that you could use in the classroom with kids that are actually written by Indigenous folks that gives a different perspective. So I just wanted to make it clear that we are super, super anti-censorship, and I think this book should still be read, but if we're reading it with our kids, we need to be reading it alongside other Indigenous voices. So that's
I was just gonna say that I think what that writer is saying is kind of what I meant earlier about how I feel like knowing the history now, there's an element of this book that is tasteless.
Right.
Because it doesn't really, even if like even an Indigenous person surviving now has to imagine what this woman went through on that island, because we have no records of it.
Right.
But There is something like kind of tasteless about the intense decontextualization of like what that survival meant for this person in the context of everything that had happened. Like in the book, it's just this like straightforward survival tale. Like I did this, this, and this, so I could get this, this, and this resource and that sort of thing. And that's really engaging. And it does kind of like that book said, or that writer said, like play into this kind of like romantic ideal of like just you in the wilderness, right? And, like, mm-hmm. I get the appeal of those stories. Like, I was in Boy Scouts. I like the outdoors a lot. Like, I like camping, like, all that sort of stuff. But, like, people don't really live like that. Like, even people in those situations, they're in those situations because of something that has happened. And it matters what's happened. Mm-hmm. Like, and the way that the book kind of takes away, it doesn't take away what happens at the beginning. It kind of shifts the historical narrative a little bit, but like for the most part, like it is fairly frank about like her family was massacred and left, but it doesn't talk at all about like that she died immediately after leaving the island, basically.
And also doesn't highlight that this was at the behest of the Russians.
At the beginning, behest of the Russians, right. Then at the behest of Spanish missionaries.
Right.
And, like, it doesn't contextualize any of that, even if it didn't. And this, like, it's just meaningful. It should be meaningful to the story that she is the last remnant. Like, this is the reimagining of a story we could never know because this people group were extinguished.
Right.
And there's a real beauty and tragedy in that the book simply never engages with. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to engage with because of how little is known about this mm-hmm. people group. And I kind of get like why you would focus on just the survival element of it. But with that in the history, mm-hmm. like it feels even more dismissive of this people group to simply turn into a survival narrative. And I don't know. Like,
When they didn't survive.
Like, it reminds me of... I have always said, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I've always said one of the worst Disney movies is the Pocahontas movie from the 90s. And not because that it's poorly made, although there's elements of it that I think are poorly made. But I think that the inherent concept of that book is, or that movie is so in like deeply offensive to me in my sensibilities. Like I understand the impulse to create a romance between a European and a native. Like, I get that. Like, that there's an appeal to that that is in a lot of narratives, but specifically Pocahontas, who basically has the same trajectory as the main character in Island of the Blue Dolphins, in the sense that as soon as she, like, lived with the, like, Europeans, she died. The original Pocahontas died, and there was no romance, there was no nothing, like, she, like, had colonization not existed, she would have survived and lived probably to be, like, a perfectly normal person within the context of her indigenous society. But the movie creates this grand mythical narrative, this romance, out of the meetings of these two people groups that eventually spelled her death in real life. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel the same way about Island of the Blue Dolphins, in the sense of there's this kind of, like, mythic, like, Old Man and the Sea quality to this narrative that is really appealing on an archetypal level, but in historical context, the only reason the situation exists is because of the horrible things that eventually resulted in this woman's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that's really tough for me to swallow.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also think there's a bigger conversation to be had of, like, I don't know how much this book is actually being recommended to kids now, like, to read as, like, course curriculum, but I feel like when we were growing up, it was still one that was consistently assigned or used to discuss, like, and used for, like, education about indigenous groups, and I think that that's really harmful. Like, let kids read it, but don't have it as, like, an educational thing of, like, here's the perspective of indigenous peoples, because, number one, each and every tribe and group of people is so different. And, again, like, we
and
need
we know
to
basically
hear,
nothing about
right,
this group.
Exactly. We need to hear from indigenous voices that are writing and making these works today that can speak to that history and that experience from not a colonial perspective. So, anyway.
I will point out, like, yeah. I don't think Scott Odell intends to make a colonial perspective. And, in fact, like, he seems disinterested in the colonists at all. Like, in a way, like, in the context of the time, that there's something very forward-thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But also the fact that he doesn't care about the colonial elements of the narrative make it kind of do reveal, like, his perspective as a white person who was not really affected by the events of the story.
Yeah. And I also, when I was reading Debbie Reese's stuff, which her stuff is great. Hopefully I can link to all of her things, because she does a very close reading of this book and highlights, like, specifically what history books Odell would have been using at that time and things. I just found to be, like, super insightful. I think this is the first Newbery book that we found as much has been written about it.
I don't think I realized that this is, like, not just in indigenous studies. Like, there's feminist readings of this. There's environmental readings. Like, this is, like, a major text in, like, the academic study of children's literature.
That's what I'm saying. When it comes to, like, a piece of literature, I think it's really strong. But the subject matter is questionable, I guess you'd say. But anyway, I lost my train of thought. Sorry, guys.
But there's a lot of writing. You were saying there's a lot of writing about this.
Oh, another... in some of the research I was doing specifically from what Debbie Reese was writing, she referenced, like a woman who was Alouette and talked about how much discrimination she suffered in school because of this book.
Oh, wow.
Because they're merely portrayed as, like, the villains of the story. And I just think that's really horrible. So, I don't know.
It's just, look, we're in America. We can make Russians the villains easily. Like, let's just pivot to that.
Well, anyway. Anyway, I still give this book a thumbs up for its literary merit. I would be very cautious about, like, reading this to my kids, though. I would want to read it with them or read another book alongside of it to, like, do kind of like a comparison thing, I think would be a way to do that responsibly. But
that's me. Yeah. If you had asked me when I first finished the book, and again, I read this as a kid, but I didn't have strong memories of it, but just now when I finished the book, if you had asked me thumbs up or thumbs down, I would have given it thumbs up. That thumbs up remains, but also I give it thumbs down, and simultaneously thumbs up and thumbs down, because, like, I just find it upsetting and hard to stomach, like, the its relation to history and what this book has done to the scope of that history in order to make it the book that I gave a thumbs up to. Mm-hmm. And so simultaneously thumbs up and thumbs down, because I had two very distinct reactions to this book.
Yeah. I like it.
Okay. Well, we've gone super long, so we'll quickly talk about next time, and then we'll sign off. So, Rebecca, what's the next book that we're reading?
We are going to read Ellen Raskin's 1979 winner, The Westing Game. Neither of us have ever read it.
It's got a very cool first edition cover, though, with this house made of dollar bills, and so I'm curious. I'm curious what that is. The 1980 book, you might remember, is a Gathering of Days. So hopefully The Westing Game does not share Gathering of Days' boring, terrible, forgettable prose.
I'm just grateful we're not in the 50s or before anymore. So, for a time. Anyway, thank you guys for listening.
Yes, thank you so much. Don't forget, you can email us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com if you're interested in giving us feedback. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to y'all later. Bye.